Hi, everyone. I feel definitely guilty after Alex's nice talk where he gave you like the overview of the field and then didn't spend very much time talking about the cool stuff that he's working on, because I'm kind of going to do the opposite. I was very happy yesterday when we went around the room to hear how many people do condensed matter and cold atom stuff. So I'm going to pretty much just talk about one project that I've been working on with undergraduates. And it's been sort of my main project for the last year. But I wrote this pretty short, so if there are things that are interesting that are slightly off topic, let's just go there. So please ask questions. I want to start with acknowledgments instead of finishing with them. A lot of this work was done with two theory collaborators, one at University of Illinois and another one who was a postdoc there. And then recently I started working with an experimentalist at Bates on this project. And here are the students who've worked on this project. They go all the way back to Meredith, who wrote the first set of some of this code, and some of these students have written their own code, and some students have used other code. And the funding has come from NSF and then recently from a NASA grant. And I want to give a shout out to the KITP, and the Aspen Center for Physics was like the initial work on this, so that was a while ago now. I totally stole this slide from Allison Harris from yesterday. I thought it was a really good idea. Maybe it's just because, like, I think visually. A little bit about myself. I was at Wellesley College from 2002 until 2012, when I moved to my current position, which is based at Smith College but shared with UMass Amherst. And if you think that's weird, it's because you don't know about the Five College Consortium. There are lots of faculty who are joint. All these schools are just like right here next to each other. So happy to talk about the joint position or why I did it. I did it for a two-body problem, which is trivial unless you actually have one. So here's my outline. This is a really short outline. I'm going to try to give you my picture, at least for this talk, of why I think BECs, both Einstein condensates, are interesting. Then I will try to convince you that collective modes of Bose-Einstein condensates are interesting, and then I'll talk about a particular theoretical approach to predicting what the collective modes would be. And the spoiler is that even though I'm a theorist, you sort of pretend you're an experimentalist when you do the simulations. So here's the big picture. Why might Bose-Einstein condensates be interesting? So here's my cartoon. You have some atoms. They're in some sort of trap. A confining trap. I'm just kind of pulling medium-sized numbers. You have like a million of them, so notice that that's a lot more than 5, but it's a lot less than 10 to the 23rd, so that's kind of where we're at. If you're at, remember, a millikelvin is still pretty cold, but it's not cold enough for these guys to really behave quantum mechanically. If they're in a gas state, they're still just going to be a gas of atoms, and then you have to get colder down to like a nanokelvin when something cool happens. And that's the thing that I'm trying to claim is cool, which is that a significant fraction of those atoms all fall into the ground, the quantum mechanical ground state, and then you actually have a macroscopic number of atoms that are all described by the same quantum mechanical wave function. So that's my take on what got me into Bose-Einstein condensation. What can you do once you have this sort of macroscopic quantum phenomena is you can I think you can use that psi that we teach in undergrad physics, but make it actually observable in a lot of ways. So you can do things like wave function manipulation. So the light colors here are where there's lots of atoms, and the dark colors are where there's no atoms, and it's because they've manufactured a wave function for that million atoms that has a funny shape that they preferred. You can see the equivalent of double slit interference. But between, you know, one cloud of a million atoms and another cloud of a million atoms, when they're allowed to expand and run into each other, you can convince yourself that each of those individual wave functions really did break the U1 symmetry, because all of these guys had one phase and all of these guys had one phase that was different, and that's the only reason why you could see interference fringes. So I think that's cool. You can also, we saw a little bit of this yesterday, you can see vortices, which are a really awesome manifestation of the broken U1 symmetry and the fact that you have millions of atoms that are all described by one equivalent single particle wave function. Yeah.
Manufacture the wave function, is that using the trap?
You're asking a good question. I think this is a funny-shaped trap, but it's possible that they did like some burnout or something. But I think the idea here would be that you could design a trap whose ground state had a particular pattern to it. And that's what I mean by wave function manipulation. Yeah. And certainly I'll be talking about traps that make things into some funny shapes. So that's the direction I want to go. Good, thanks. Okay, that was all of my Bose-Einstein condensate being interesting. So I want you to be thinking about it being interesting because it's a macroscopic manifestation of a single particle wave function. What are collective modes of Bose-Einstein condensates and why might they be interesting? So collective modes, if you think of the Bose-Einstein condensate now as kind of like a quantum fluid, collective modes are just the lowest lying excitations of the entire quantum fluid. So I'm not thinking about single particle excitations, I'm thinking about the quantum fluid of the BEC moving in some way. Let's think about one of the simpler ones. This is usually called the sloshing mode. So if you have a BEC trapped in just a regular harmonic potential, you could imagine in some way, and we can talk about this, displacing either the trap or the BEC in some linear direction. And then what you will see is it will just oscillate back and forth, like the ball rolling around at the bottom. And the thing that's kind of neat, at least about this geometry, is that the frequency of that collective mode is going to be exactly the same as if you just had one rubidium atom oscillating in the bottom of the trap. You only have that one sort of single particle frequency, and that's what you're going to see. Okay, so that's the sloshing mode. There's three of them. I just want to remind you that we're actually in 3D. Okay, there's another mode, though, of that spherical ball-like condensate, where instead of sloshing back and forth inside the trap, all that happens is that the outer edge expands and contracts and expands and contracts. This is called the breathing mode. This is a little bit more interesting because now the frequency, you can still express it in terms of the single particle harmonic frequency, but it's not equal to it. So, and the frequency that you see for these collective mode oscillations will depend on how strong the interactions are between the atoms that are in the condensate. So in the limit of weak or zero interactions, you're going to get that this breathing mode has double the frequency of the sloshing mode, or just of the fundamental frequency of the trap. Whereas if you're in the strong interaction limit, you're going to get something a little bit more than two. Yeah?
Is there some easy way to understand root 5?
No. Not that I know of. I mean, I could rederive it for you, but I'm not sure if I could give you like a hand-wavy counting states argument or anything like that. Yeah.
But this smoothly interpolates based on if, say, you increase the density, say?
Yes, it should. These two results are both done, you know, analytically, and you wouldn't be able to go to the intermediate regime, but I think if you did it numerically, you would just get a nice, smooth crossover.
Physically,
they've got to, absolutely.
Right.
Not that I'm aware of, no. But that's a good question. There isn't, because you can just take that interaction all the way from zero up to whatever you want it to be. Yeah. Okay, good. Now, that was me trying to convince you that collective modes would be interesting. This collective mode, the breathing mode, immediately starts bringing in the effective interactions. So I think that's interesting. I'm going to ask you to think about a different geometry. Not completely different, just different. Instead of having a harmonic trap centered like this, one way to think about this would be like a double well potential or a harmonic trap that's off-centered. What would a condensate do if the minimum of potential energy was out at some finite radius, but you still had spherical symmetry? It would be a spherical shell. So it would still, from the outside, look like a cloud, but the inside would essentially be hollow. Okay, this should have collective modes as well. Let's set some variables, because now we have two things that could be varying. We've got like the mean radius of this cloud, of the condensate. Let's call that R0, and then we've got the thickness of the condensate. What should those be determined by? That mean radius in equilibrium has to just be where the minimum is. Okay, what's the thickness? The thickness has to do with how tight this confinement is. Because if you imagine a wave function sitting in here it's going to be more narrow if this is a tighter confinement, or it's going to be wider. So these are two independent parameters that you can tune essentially by this R naught and this omega naught. Okay, now, just in case we need it later, here's how this would actually look if you were doing a simulation. Because this is spherically symmetric, you would just take a cut through. And then, like, if this is the wave function axis here, or the density axis, and this is R, you would just see two bumps. And so that mean radius R naught is how far the peak is from R equals 0. And the thickness, R1, is essentially some measure of the thickness of the condensate density, so full width at half max, or whatever you want. Okay, now, what should the collective modes of this be? Well, even if we just think about spherically symmetric modes, we automatically have two possibilities that are kind of like breathing modes. One is that the thickness stays, okay, almost the same. Can't stay exactly the same because of particle conservation. But it stays approximately the same, and then just that mean radius changes. Does that make sense? Okay, so here you would just see those peaks moving out and in and out and in, but their thickness wasn't changing very much. Okay, this, some previous work in a particular approximation, we showed that this should actually have the same frequency as a single particle rolling around in the bottom of this double well. Okay, so this is the thing that should just in some way be protected. This should happen whether it's strong or weak interactions. Now, we could only show this in what's called the thin shell limit. So if you really make the shell big enough or thin enough, it's really just the ratio between those two, then you can take this as a 1D problem. And that's where you can show this. So you already can kind of see a clue of what we might want to do, which is to get better than the thin shell limit. The other breathing type mode, though, would be where the mean radius stays approximately the same and the thickness just changes. If you are thinking about doing this as a differential equation problem, I've been putting like the L and N quantum numbers that you would have for these up there, in case you're worried about that. For this mode is where, again, in the thin shell limit, we were able to show that you would have two different frequencies depending on whether you were at the weak limit or the strong limit. I don't know why, in this case, the weak limit has a higher frequency than the strong. I'm sorry, I just don't know. I can show you. Again, I mean, it's like you're using a particular approximation, but I kind of believe it. I'll show you some numerics. We kind of only do numerics in one limit or the other, but I still think this is right, but I don't know why it's the inverse of the other one. Yeah.
Just conjecture. Could there be some dimensionality factor that's happening?
That's such a good question. There could. The thing that's weird is that the spherical breathing mode is also a 1D problem because it's just in R, and this is a 1D problem. And so there wasn't any obvious Z or something that I could point to where I was like, oh, this is why we're getting this stupid answer.
The numerical methods that you use, can you use the same techniques in both the weak and the strong?
We can. And this is not numerical. This is actually analytical. But I'll show you the numerical methods. And I think we can, although we may run into some issues if we go too weak. But yeah, I'll get to it.
Is there experimental confirmation?
No, that's what the guy at Bates is supposed to be doing. So I'll tell you how you could make one of these things experimentally. The hard thing is you can't make it in gravity. So that's why the NASA grant. So the idea is that NASA is interested in maybe trying this out on the International Space Station in the Cold Atom Lab, which surprised the heck out of me when we got the grant. But they thought this was interesting too. Okay. So that's what we knew, you know, probably actually 5 years ago or more, about these collective modes of a hollow sphere. And we thought this might be interesting, but our first paper, it was like, this is not realistic. But then there are experimentalists who are interested in making a trap that would have, that would be spherically symmetric but would have the minimum out at finite radius. This is a two-dimensional picture of how you do that, but you can see our friend, the like sort of wine bottle potential coming out of what's really sort of two different optical traps there. I took this from an experiment where they were actually trying to do a 2D version, so they were trying to make a ring, but the same trap, if you just do it in 3D, will make a shell. Okay, and I don't want to put awful equations up here, but since it's theorists, you can probably immediately see this is not the trap that's just off-centered, The off-center trap is kind of ugly at r equals 0 because it has a cusp. This is actually a nice, smooth potential that, unlike your friend, the usual double well is not quartic at large r, because that's not physical to actually do with light. So this is something that's quadratic at large r. You can convince yourself of it, especially if you have a piece of paper, if you need one. And it is cool because the mean radius, so the place where the minimum is controlled by this thing delta. And the sort of frequency of small oscillations, or the tightness around that minimum, is controlled by the ratio of delta to this other thing, big omega. My point, though, is that as you take delta to zero, you smoothly turn into the quadratic potential. So you have the possibility in this experimentally realistic trap to tune between something that's kind of in the thin shell limit all the way to the thing that'll be the filled sphere. So then the question is, what happens to those collective modes? We know what happens for the filled sphere. We have theories about what happens for the shell out at very thin shells. How do we actually interpolate between the two? Yeah.
But that square root of 3 omega naught, that's for perfectly quadratic?
But this is that in a thin shell limit. So if you take this and you expand around the minimum, it looks quadratic. So if you do a Taylor expansion of this, which would be valid exactly in the thin shell limit, you'll get that same potential. So we do expect the thin shell limit to be the same as this, and we know it, the sphere has to be the same as the sphere because it's exactly the same potential. Good question. Okay, so now I'll tell you what we actually did. So we had these analytical thin shell results. We have the filled sphere. You can't really do any analytics on this for arbitrary shell thickness and arbitrary interaction, because what you're doing is you're solving the Gross-Podievsky equation. So this is a modification of the Schrodinger equation for multiple atoms all being in that same state psi. The thing that's different is this term here, which is the interaction term. It basically just says that the atoms are repulsive, but this is from a contact interaction, which is pretty realistic for neutral atoms. Okay, so if you put on your math hat for a second, though, this is a partial nonlinear differential equation, so not super easy to find solutions to. So we do it numerically. We use some numerical just differential equations on a lattice techniques. These are from like 2005, so they're not that recent, but they're not from like 1820, so they're somewhat recent. and we just, this is first order in time, so we just turn the crank in terms of time evolution. First, though, you have to figure out what your starting state is before you can time evolve it. So to find the ground state, you set this to zero, and you're trying to solve the time-independent Schrodinger equation. And we're doing that with an imaginary time algorithm, which I'm happy to talk about, but it's very cool, and undergrads totally get it if they've taken quantum, because the steps are, like, obvious. Here's what we decided to do. We want to simulate the collective modes and figure out what their frequency is. How can we do that? Okay, one way you might think about that is, okay, I'm looking for the frequency of the normal modes. I'm going to write down some math. I'm going to try to turn the crank on it, but you're going to keep running into this nonlinear term, and your crank's not going to go very far. So we said, no. You know what we're going to do is we're going to kind of do what we expect the experimentalists do to actually find this, which is to make the BEC in a particular trap, meaning it has a particular mean radius and it has a particular, thickness. And then what they can do, what they actually would have a knob for, is to change that trap in some way. So basically kick the system. And then what will it do when you kick it? It will oscillate. And those oscillations have to be the normal modes of the system. So that's what we did numerically. We would find the ground state, using a somewhat clever algorithm here to take into account the nonlinearity. So find the ground state for a particular mean radius and a particular thickness, and then change one of those. And then after you've changed it, use a different time evolution algorithm to sort of time evolve the Schrodinger equation and see what the condensate wave function actually does, and then see if you can pull out the frequencies.
So At some level, you might be able to use linear response, right? That is, find
a particular state that you're interested in and then just linearize about that state. Is there an obvious reason why, when that doesn't work?
I think this nonlinear term kind of always messes you up. You can't even find the ground state with that nonlinear term analytically. But you're right, we're making only a small change. So in some ways, maybe we're relying on the idea of linear response in the sense that maybe the frequency would be different if we made a larger change. We're making like a perturbative change.
I mean, it still would be numerical, my guess.
Yeah. We should talk. I don't know. I didn't see a way to do it because what you have as your initial state is just all these numbers on a grid. And then the question is, how am I going to figure out how those numbers change when I change this one parameter? But there might be a way to do it. That reminded me of something. Oh, it's a slight change, but it's sudden. Okay, so at t equals zero, the potential suddenly changes from one thing to another. My understanding of the experiment is that you can change these knobs pretty quickly because you're essentially changing probably the frequency of some light, or you're changing maybe the intensity of a light. So that's why I call this a quench. It's non-equilibrium because you find the equilibrium in a particular potential and then you suddenly change the potential and see how the system responds. Okay, let me orient you a little bit to the pictures. So this is what I wanted you to picture when I was like holding my hands out. The slightly darker region would be the actual condensate, and then the inside would be kind of hollow. What we actually see, you know, on our grid is something more like this, where this is our density or wave function squared axis, and then, you know, in two of the coordinates, this is spherically symmetric, you would see some bump. Okay, and then in fact, I'm usually going to turn this so that you can see it, so it'll just look like a ring, but you want to be picturing it as the full sphere. So what happens if we, so this is after a change in that radius parameter, that delta, and this is just a movie of the time evolution of the wave function. Now what were the two modes we were looking at? One was where the radius moved back and forth, and the other was where the thickness changed. What you would notice is that you have both. You should have both, because otherwise you can't conserve particle number if just one of those things changes. So it was kind of like a bonus. We didn't have to do two simulations to get this, to get both modes. Oops. Trying to see. There we go. So this is, again, what it looks like in just a cut, kind of dancing around. Sorry, that happened a little bit faster than I wanted it to. Well, did you see it enough? For some reason, the view that I'm in PowerPoint is kind of annoying. But I did this because I thought maybe it would give you an idea. What you can do is you can find the location of the peak. That's like the mean radius. And you can find the full width at half max. And you can just plot both of those as a function of time. And you're going to see oscillations. And then what are you going to do to find the frequencies? You're going to take the Fourier transform. Yeah, and you're going to get a couple of peaks because these are actually happening at different frequencies. And you could see in that movie that they were happening at different frequencies because they weren't lined up. Yeah.
So was the previous movie a cut from a three-dimensional simulation, or was it a two-dimensional? Okay.
It was a cut from a fully three-dimensional simulation.
Okay.
Yeah. They're all fully 3D. We just pick an axis to kind of cut on. We could do them in spherical coordinates and essentially have a 1D simulation, but then we wouldn't be able to access the sloshing mode. So we just did it stupid and just did a Cartesian coordinate system and just did the full 3D grid. Right, so with those movies, we can extract at least two frequencies. I think we probably excite all of the L equals zero modes, but the amplitude of each of those modes is probably going down, so we can only really resolve at this point two frequencies. Now I want to take you back to this plot, because what I'm going to show you next is how does that frequency change, how do both of those frequencies change as you go from a shell continuously into a sphere. So this is the part that we're still a little bit confused about. This is a really busy plot. I apologize, my student was not very good at making not busy plots. In black is the lowest lying mode. That was the one where just the radius changed. That's the one that we expected in the thin shell limit to be the same as the frequency of small oscillations of a single atom. And we're seeing it being pretty close to one pretty much the whole way. Sorry, this axis here is that thing delta that controls the location of the minimum of the trap. So out here is a thin shell, and at zero delta is the filled sphere. Here's the weird part, though. So for that mode, it's n equals 1. It's the lowest lying mode. For the thin shell, it sits about at the natural frequency 1. But then we know that the n equals 1 filled sphere is the breathing mode. And that's all the way up here at something like 2, or bigger than 2. So there appears to be a jump. Is that obvious? I wasn't expecting a jump. I was expecting something that was 1 out here in the thin shell, and then did something smooth to get up to the square root of 5 when it was over here. And that's totally not what we're seeing, and I don't know why. So our collaborators at University of Illinois are taking a different approach using hydrodynamic equations, and they can access this regime here where the delta is really small. We were having a hard time with our numerics doing that, so hopefully they can tell us whether there's just a really steep increase or whether there actually seems to be a discontinuous jump. Yeah.
So this is the mode. This is the mode where it's just
the shell oscillating.
It's this part,
yeah, right,
oscillating,
so,
not the thickness.
Right, so once it's filled, there's a thing that disappears, right? It's topologically distinct. So it's not clear that it should be so surprising. I mean, you don't have a shell anymore. You have just a filled-in ball. So there's a topology change. You're oscillating on one side now, right? I mean, you don't have...
You don't have the other side.
You don't have the other side.
Yeah.
So I guess given that topological change, it seems less surprising to me, but...
I agree with you. I don't throw around the word topology lightly because I know I use it wrong sometimes, but I trust that you probably use it right. I think that's topology, but I'm not positive.
Right.
The other thing that's a little bit weird about this potential is that to say like there's an instant where the inner edge goes away is not really true, because remember these have tails. So they're kind of always, you know, once you get to like this, if you want to be precise about it, the wave function density is not zero here.
Right.
It's just really small.
So back to my question then, on the previous, on that graph.
On this graph or
the one? No, the one with the big jump.
Yeah.
So have you tried seeing what happens as delta is, you know, 1, 2, 3, rather than just out of 25 or something?
Yeah, we want to. We can't. Our numerical technique is not doing well there. We're seeing the nonlinearity is kind of killing us, and it just gets messy. That's why our collaborators are using a hydrodynamic equation solution, and they can access this regime, so they're doing that now.
And then, I mean, because then conceivably, right, it's not a sharp cutoff, but then
exactly
once you sort of hit that, you're getting an appreciable amount into that thing, so it's not as sort of
yeah.
So
I think it has to be smooth for exactly
yeah,
that reason, because
the
thing doesn't fill itself in automatically, but it may do it.
It's got to be very close. Yeah.
It may do it very, you know, suddenly. As far as the condensate is concerned, this might be like a rapid change. Yeah.
Just one question first. So where are interactions in this one?
Good. In our numerics, we just worked at a particular interaction strength that was relevant for the experiment. So we grabbed one that that Nathan said was like the right one.
And then sort of related to what you're talking about, in a harmonic trap, you have that... I mean, like when you do this, right, you're getting an extra length scale as soon as you go away from that limit. So,
yeah.
So there really is a symmetry breaking, and it's even there's even a name for it. I mean, it's a kind of scale. I mean, you could do it as a scale invariance problem, although it's a dynamic symmetry. Anyway, there's a really great paper that I ought to show you by Kasten and Werner if you haven't read it yet, because I think that could be a really nice language for talking about the symmetry breaking there.
Yeah, that would be awesome. Don't forget to give me that. Okay. Yeah, because that I feel like there's something happening here that should be obvious to me that I can't quite figure out, so that would be super. That's kind of why I went, that's the word I'm looking for. I went greedy and just talked about my stuff so you guys can give me help on it. So that's that lowest lying mode. We see this jump when we get to the sphere. It may not be surprising, but the thing that I found unfortunate is that our numerics are not finding the transition region very well. So that's a bummer, but hopefully we can do it with the other numerics.
Is there a reason why you have frequency less than 1 as you approach that?
I think that, you know, they're all kind of consistent with 1. I think probably our error bars are not as big as they should be. Again, the simulations get harder the smaller the delta is, because once you start getting some condensate in the middle, then for some reason it just becomes a little bit less stable. And our error bars are really dependent on how long we're able to run because of the Fourier transform. And so when you have instabilities getting worse, it just means that you can't run for quite as long. So I think these should probably be larger error bars that just include one. The higher level mode where it's the thickness changing is a little bit more interesting if you're interested in interactions, because that was the one that you should have in the thin shell limit. We had predictions for what should happen at weak interactions and strong interactions. Strong interactions are in green for some reason, and weak interactions are in red. So this looks in the thin shell limit as though we're in the weak interaction limit, but when you go to the filled sphere, that mode, remember, for weak interactions was up at, no, sorry, for strong interactions was up at the square root of 5, and for weak interactions was at 2. And our data point, okay, is not excluding the weak interactions, but it's definitely strong, closer to the strong interactions. So we are using the same atomic interaction strength throughout our simulations, but we're seeing that in the thin shell, we're closer to a weak interaction limit, and for the filled sphere, we're closer to the strong interaction limit, and you would go, why? But sorry, this just reminds you of what those were. So this is seeming to be weak for the thin shell and seeming to be strong for the sphere, but that actually totally makes sense if you go back to the Gross-Podievsky equation, because your interaction term depends on the density. And when you've taken the same number of particles and confined them out to a really thin shell, the density just isn't that large, because you've got this huge 4 pi r squared that you're spreading them out over. Whereas when you take that same number of atoms and you cram them into a spherical trap, they're actually, the density is much, much higher. So what we're seeing is that for an experimentally realistic thing, which is to actually keep the microscopic interactions the same, we're tuning between the weak interaction limit and the strong interaction limit. It also means that any predictions for the strong interaction limit of a thin shell might not be experimentally feasible, because you're just always going to get killed by that thinness, and the density is going to be low, and you're going to have to go to fundamental interaction strengths that are so incredibly high that they're not physical. So that's a caution to people doing theory out at strong interactions. We did also look at the equivalent of the sloshing mode. You can imagine taking this funny potential and actually offsetting it in some particular direction. So you're breaking the spherical symmetry, you're going like in the x direction. And what you might expect is that the entire shell just goes from here to here to here to here. Okay, that would be an L equals 1 mode. This would be the N equals 1 or 0, L equals 1 mode. That should also happen right at this frequency of the harmonic approximation out of the thin shell. Let's see if I can make this go. Sorry, it's kind of small, but you can see it's basically doing that. This is the direction of the offset, so that's x. There are actually two modes, though. There are an infinite number of modes for L equals 1, but we're actually seeing two modes here, the one where the whole thing just moves, but then there's another one that's kind of funny where like the outer radius and the inner radius move out of phase with each other. So we are actually seeing both of those. And we only have a filled sphere prediction for the lowest lying mode, which should be 1, and we're pretty close to 1 when we do the filled sphere. And so this mode seems to be pretty boring as you go from the thin shell to the filled sphere. But maybe it had to be boring because they were all just going to be omega naught. The N equals 2 mode, which is the one where the inner and outer radius are out of phase, might be doing something more interesting as we approach the filled sphere. But we couldn't do numerics on the filled sphere N equals 2 mode because we didn't know what it looked like. Because again, there's not an inner radius anymore. It must exist, but we just couldn't come up with a perturbation that would make it happen. And I have searched literature and I couldn't find any predictions for what this mode should look like for the filled sphere, but I probably just didn't look hard enough.
But the picture looked a little bit like it was somehow not staying spherical.
Yeah, that's a good question.
So it could be coupling to L equals 2 or something, changing to a...
I don't think it can because of... I think there's a selection rule there. But for some reason, my PowerPoint doesn't like playing movies after it's already played them. No. I'm sure I could come out.
And then it's okay.
But I don't know. I think there's some funny things about your eye when you look at this.
Yeah. get the slides.
I have like no, no, I'm sorry. I'll show it to you later. We didn't see, what didn't we see? I should look at that because I don't have a lot of intuition for L equals 2 versus L equals 1, but I think there's an extra symmetry that would have to get broken. But that's it. So we can have more questions. I hope I've convinced you that the collective modes of Bose-Einstein condensates are interesting and that this funny shell-shaped condensate might be interesting. The numerics that we're suggesting might be a cool way to do things would be to mimic the experiments pretty precisely and find the ground state in one potential and then just time evolve in another potential, and that would show you what the excitations of the system are. We need to think more about what's actually happening as the filled sphere is approached. I don't think it can be a discontinuity, but we'd like to know more about how that ramp actually happens, and I think the stuff we found out about the effective strength of interactions changing is important, even if in retrospect it's kind of obvious. So that's it. Thanks.
Oh, you probably have mentioned this. How did you experimentally achieve this thin shell of condensate?
Yeah, so it's, I'm not going to do it a lot of justice, but they basically, okay, so where is it? Okay, so this, it's kind of like they take one normal trapping potential and they put an extra one on top of it that's upside down. And when those two add, you get these two potentials, one that kind of looks like that nice double well potential, and the other one that looks like this upside down. And then you just try to make sure the atoms are all transferred into this one. Because this one is still just a boring harmonic trap, whereas this is the one where sort of this is like energy as a function of radius. So they can do it with existing optical techniques. This is actually exactly what they do to do evaporative cooling. They just do evaporative cooling in this trap, and instead they're trying to load into this state. Uh-huh. So it's kind of, it's not brand new physics for the trap.
So in the end, you wind up with half a shell of condensate.
No, sorry. So this is like R. Uh-huh. But this is R equals zero. So this is actually in 3D. So you end up with the entire three-dimensional shell. With the potential that, as a function of R, they shouldn't show it like this because R stops at zero, but that's what it looks like as a function of R, and so it's fully spherically symmetric. Try to ignore this picture. This is just a two-dimensional image of it, but it confuses you because it's two-dimensional instead of three-dimensional. There was another hand, though. Yeah.
Could some of the discrepancies between theory and your numerics be because you are kicking your gas too hard?
We're not kicking it very hard, but what do you mean by discrepancy?
For example, the fact that you have your green dot here below the curve, but then...
Oh, but I think this is in the weak interaction limit.
Oh, so
the red dot is the weak interaction limit, and we totally match with that.
Right, but you showed that on the other side...
Yeah, and that's because for a filter, we're in the strong interaction limit.
Oh, okay, so you have it...
Yeah, if you just look at the density... as a function of delta. Here you have a really high density, so you should be in the strong interaction limit, and here you have a really low density, so you should be in the weak interaction limit. I don't think this is a discrepancy.
But you have a measure for how far you kick the gas, or how much you change the trapping potential.
And we do it for a bunch of them and make sure we always get the same result.
I see.
Yeah, so we in practice, I think we've just been changing R naught, but we've also changed that frequency to make sure we get the same results.
So on the when you kick it in your simulation, is it a delta function?
It is a step function.
Step function. Okay.
So you find the ground state with one value of delta, and then at t equals zero, you suddenly change to a different value of R naught, and then you run forward in time with that new value of R naught. So that's why it's like a quench. It's very sudden.
Have you tried to like the Fermi function? You know how it turn on? How it's not completely a step.
The problem, we The thing that I worry about with that is that the simulations are discrete in time. So you have to ask yourself, what am I like actually doing in terms of how fast am I changing the potential versus how fast am I changing my my simulation time? And so I think as long as the experimenters can turn the knob faster than some of these periods, we actually, the sudden approximation should be okay. I think we could do a varying potential. It just makes me nervous because you don't want to take the step size in your simulation, your time step size in your simulation too literally, because you want it actually to be zero, but you just can't make it zero. Yeah.
So, and maybe this is just something you've already said or sort of related. So when you do classical waves sometimes, and you're thinking about, I guess, either a solid or a fluid or a liquid or whatever, you sometimes think about Poisson's ratio, which tells you that if you're sort of squeezing it, you know, it sort of takes into account some part of the elasticity and the density of the medium that says, oh, well, if you're squeezing it, if you try to have a compression wave this way, that's going to cause squeezing or squirting in the other direction.
Right.
And that can actually cause coupling between these other kinds of modes,
yeah.
Right? So is there any sort of like a mechanical analogy like this possible for these systems?
I'm sure it's possible, yeah. And that's just my own ignorance about solid mechanics or fluid mechanics. But the thing is, I don't need anything that complicated to understand why these modes are coupled, because just particle number conservation
right.
tells me they have to be coupled.
Right. Which
but
is basically just
the
Poisson ratio is
just the
conservation
same.
Of matter.
See,
it's just conservation of matter.
Dynamics.
It just like
yeah.
you squeeze it this way, it's gotta squirt out some way.
But yeah, we should probably figure out what that analogy is, because there's a lot of things about this that are basically the same as
yeah.
fluid dynamics, just with a somewhat funny time evolution. Yeah.
I have a question about the mode with frequency one.
Yeah.
In a 3D trap that's not a ring. It
okay.
It corresponds to just sloshing in along some axis. And
yeah.
There are three of them.
Let me see if I can find it. Yeah.
And if I think about a ring.
Yeah.
Like this big ring limit, is it right for me to think about kind of a one-dimensional problem?
Absolutely.
And so. Then in the big ring limit, that mode would correspond to an oscillation with spherical symmetry. And because if I think about it as a one-dimensional problem in a radial coordinate, the
yeah.
slosh mode would be...
But there is no other dimension then. You're really in just 1D.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there probably shouldn't be a continuous crossover between, I mean, as you... The mode with frequency one, as you introduce the ring, should go away, and another one should be introduced with frequency one. That's my intuition.
So you don't think of the same mode? Yeah.
Maybe, because one has spherical symmetry and the other one doesn't.
The problem is, so if you're in the 1D limit, you have to be a thin shell.
Mm-hmm.
So as you were thinking about approaching the filled sphere, at some point your 1D approximation is going to break down. But I mean, that's a good question. I don't know how to tell whether these modes are the same. Like, I don't know what that means really. I think there has to be some smooth evolution of the frequencies. But you're right, there are all these symmetry changes that are happening. But I mean, yeah, if you have a mode with frequency omega naught and another mode with frequency omega naught, it's like, last night, everything in my house was stolen and replaced with an exact replica. You know, like, I don't know how I would tell that they weren't the same mode. You know, it's like, so apologies to Stephen Wright, because that's his joke. But I think we need to think a little bit more about symmetry, so that's why I'm interested in the paper that you're going to show me.
So you start with a ground. The ground state for a certain potential, right? And then you change your potential slightly. So the new function should be, it should read, so the original function should be now a superposition of the states for mm-hmm. your new potential, right? And
yeah.
then you pick, I just want to understand the technique. So you.
Oh no, we don't solve anything. No. Sorry. So we don't. We do not find the eigenstates of the new potential. In fact, we never find anything but the ground state of a potential. What we do is we take an initial wave function and then we find it at the next time step. And then we find it at the next time step. This is a finite difference equation. We don't do any spectrum. And the reason we don't do that is because the thing that the wave function is really an expansion in time is the collective modes. And those are the things we're looking for. Does that make sense? It's not, I don't think it's best thought of as an expansion of the eigenstates of the new potential, because there's this interaction term. And A, you can't find those eigenstates because of the interaction term. But so we're doing something much dumber. We're just saying, okay, you have your initial t equals 0 wave function. Now write this as psi at the next t minus psi at the first t and use it to find psi at the next t and then do it again and then do it again and then do it again.
Could you put up the plot of the potential again?
Yeah. Where was it? There.
So.
Oh, you want it with the functional form?
No, this with functional form, either way is fine. But
it's easy.
Do you have one with the functional form in?
Yeah, that was just earlier.
Yeah. So you effectively have a. So if I were to continue and interpolate, you're always going to have a double bump until the very end.
Yeah.
But the double bump is moving in?
The minimum is moving in and the bottom is dropping out.
Yeah. And they hit zero right at the same time.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. No, that's a really important point. If you just take delta to zero and you don't change this big omega factor, then you're getting different frequencies of small oscillations. So what we do is we take delta to zero and we keep this ratio fixed. So big omega is also zero. If you take delta to zero without taking big omega to zero, you don't technically get back the just regular harmonic trap.
So you're still having a phase transition right at this point.
Do I want to call it a phase transition?
Yeah, the structure of the minima is changing, right? I'm going from two minima to one.
That's true. Well, you're really going from minimum, one offset. Remember, this actually is a ring.
You're going from a ring.
Yeah.
Yes, spontaneously, right? So just but in this cross section. So, but in the ring, you're going from a ring of minima to a unique minimum. That's not a continuous thing.
It isn't.
It's continuous in terms of the function.
Exactly.
But there are also discontinuities when you take derivatives and whatnot. So I guess it doesn't surprise me that you would get. You might just think this is a sort of field theory problem, right? Going from a broken phase to an unbroken phase.
Yeah.
And the modes are going to change at that point.
Yeah, so, I mean, wouldn't it be awesome if we had some universality class or something? Yeah.
And I mean, and effectively, that's what's happening when you're going to the filled-in shell, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know that it surprises me that you have a discontinuity, would have a discontinuity other than you're doing numerics, so the numerics are kind of smearing out these two situations.
But I actually, I agree with you. What I'm worried about is I think there might not ever be a true discontinuity because this thing is not a point. It is actually, at even this potential, it is already filled in to some extent. It just has less density here than it has here. So I don't know if I expect there to be a true discontinuity. And you're right that we should be worried about whether we can ever find it.
I mean, the same points up that you have an additional length scale, which shows up. So anyway,
but wouldn't that topological argument hold irrespective of interactions?
Yeah.
So you could just do it for the single particle Schrodinger equation.
Well, it tells you what's possible. It doesn't tell you that. Right? Tell you there has to be a jump. It tells you it's consistent for there to be a discontinuity of some kind. It doesn't force it on you. You know, I mean, I could have two things which aren't forced to be the same, but happen to be equal. I mean, presumably because there's some other, I'll say selection rule in quotes. I mean, not really a selection rule, but some other property.
It seems like the non-interacting case would be easy to check.
Yeah, ironically, so. I need to review how the how these collective modes, like the original sphere, I think if you don't have any interactions, you might like not actually get anything. because the interactions are, I mean, weak interactions is different than zero interactions. You actually won't have a BEC if there's no interactions at all. So you won't get the breaking of the symmetry. So it's, there are some subtleties that might happen, but you're right, we can, we should think about whether we can check things at zero interactions and figure out what's happening. Because you're right, this change in the potential has nothing to do with it.
Have you tried, since you're doing a sudden quench, have you tried going from a ring topology or double valve all of a sudden to a single harmonic trap? Because that's something that they can actually do an experiment and see cool dynamics.
Technically, that is what we're doing at the smallest ones of these, I think. Although maybe not. I'll need to check. Yeah, I mean, I think, do you want to go from the sphere to the shell, or do you want to go from the shell to the sphere?
Doesn't matter, but
it does matter in the numerics. So that's the question.
Right, but what I'm proposing is a complete change of the topology of your trap all of a sudden. You're in each of these points, you're just kicking or changing your trap.
But at our smallest value of delta, the only way to go is to go to zero. So I think
at that point, you can change it to a big delta.
So you want to make a big quench. See, the thing I'm worried about doing, because that's the part that where the time would start to worry me, the fact that I'm making an instantaneous change. If I'm making a big change, that makes me uncomfortable.
No, but then you have again some initial
psi, and you evolve it.
I know I could do it, but does it have any relevance for experiment?
I mean, they can do it, right?
I don't know if they can do it fast enough. That's my point. If it's a really large change, I start to worry about the time it takes to make the ramp. And since I'm not doing a continuous time thing, we could do it. I haven't done it because I'm not sure. If we saw something crazy, I wouldn't have any idea whether to believe it.
I would imagine those are lasers, right? So maybe they can turn on and off.
Yeah, yeah. It's worth trying. I don't want to keep us from our pizza. I'm like the only thing standing between you and your lunch.
I have a dumb question. What does CAL stand for?
Ah, Cold Atom Laboratory. So it.
Oh, it's up there.
It's up on the. No, wouldn't that be awesome? Then they would have to give me the money. No, the Cold Atom Lab is basically a BEC on a chip thing where they have a chip that will make all the magnetic fields necessary to make whatever potential you want, and then they have rubidium up there, and they probably have sodium or something also. And it's almost like a user facility where you write a grant for time on the cold atom chip, and you tell them what programming you want to do for the currents and everything, and then they run your experiment in space. I didn't say the reason why you need that is because if you picture a potential that's supposed to confine this thing to a shell, gravity makes it sag. And then it's not a shell anymore. It has a little hole at the top, a little bald spot. So the only place where you could really get a full shell would be to go to microgravity. And so that's why NASA is interested in it.
Is it on the space station?
It is on the space station.
Inside? Yeah.
I think ours is on the next generation, so it's not on the space station
No,
yet.
No, but is it in manned space, whatever you call it, environment of the space station?
I think so. I think some Russian is probably twiddling the knobs, yeah, because we don't send people up there anymore. Yeah.
Has this been done in two dimensions?
The theory or the experiment?
Well, originally weren't all the quantum corrals and...
Yeah, they've made that ring trap.
Yeah.
But they haven't seemed to be interested in this question at all. When they make the ring trap, what they're interested in is 1D physics.
Right.
They're trying to get, you know.
It might be interesting to see if these questions about whether there's a break or not, even for you, in theory, in two dimensions.
Yeah, so going from a disk to a ring?
Yeah.
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 It just, I don't think it'll be any easier.
Okay.
That's the reason why we just did 3D, is because it seemed like, well.
That's often true, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's still just like a really ugly differential equation. Yeah. Good question. Can we be done? Yeah.